Hello, welcome to Reflections on the Scriptures. It's great to have you join us today. My name's Murray Shanks and I'm the pastor of Foster Baptist Church on the mid-north coast of New South Wales in Australia. Let's dive back into our series through the book of Acts. We are quickly approaching the end of Luke's account, though certainly not the end of the story, for the story will continue on and on all the way down to us and will ultimately continue on and on through all of eternity. This is part of the great story of God's redemption of all creation. You remember that Paul has been imprisoned in Caesarea for the past 2 years. The Jewish authorities have brought ridiculous trumped-up charges against him. They want him gone. They want him dead. And it seems that they're willing to plumb any depth to achieve this end. Eventually, after a number of court hearings, Paul makes an official appeal to Caesar, which is granted. He then is packed off to sea, hoping to eventually make it to Rome. Anyone reading Luke's two great works, the Gospel according to Luke and the Acts of the Apostles, will eventually see the parallels all the way through the two accounts. Jesus makes a series of journeys, ministering to people all over Judea, eventually ending up in Jerusalem. Paul makes a series of journeys, ministering to people all over the Greek-speaking world, eventually ending up in Jerusalem. Jesus stands trial before a Roman governor, Pilate, and stands before a Jewish king, Herod Antipas. Paul stands trial before a couple of Roman governors, Felix and Festus, and is also brought before a Jewish king, Herod Agrippa. Jesus is sentenced to death on a Roman cross. Death, the great unknown, the centre of all our fears. Paul is sent to Rome, or so it would appear at first reading. However, Paul is really sent to sea on a ship, the sea being the centre of all their fears. Now, at this point, it's worth thinking about the Jewish attitudes towards the sea, because they are very much like the way we see death. Tom Wright says that the Jews were not a seafaring race. They left that to the Egyptians to the south and the Phoenicians to the north, not to mention the Greeks, who were never happier than when messing about in island-hopping boats and ferries and seaborne businesses and temples to Poseidon or Neptune, as the Romans called him. But for the Jews, the sea was a monster. The sea was regarded by the Jews as a dark force, you see, something which had a malevolent, sinister nature, something from which evil powers emerged. The sea, for the Jews, was like death. Way back in the very beginning, the opening verses of the Bible, we read about the Spirit of God hovering over the waters, over the deep chaos. But then his good creation brings light, order, safety, and glory to the chaos. When we think about Israel's history, their great national story, we find Yahweh delivering them from slavery in Egypt by parting the sea. The Lord drove a great wedge right down the middle of this malevolent, sinister darkness which threatened them, blocking their escape route. And they walked through on dry land. Not so for the Egyptians in hot pursuit. As they tried to follow, the sea came crashing back down over them, wiping them out in a single violent stroke. Hundreds of years later, Daniel envisaged the history of God's people in terms of the wicked world empires rising up against them. Quite predictably, he saw four monsters coming up out of, well, where else? The sea. These monsters, these evil world empires, would eventually be stripped of their power and be annihilated by Yahweh. Of course, our mind also goes to the story of Jonah being thrown overboard into the raging sea as he tries to run from God, and also to the Apostle John being exiled in the island of Patmos, separated from the rest of civilization by the dreadful sea. John ultimately has a vision of God's glorious new heaven and new earth where there is no sea. Of course, one has to wonder where all of the rivers in John's vision, especially the river of life, flowed, if not into an ocean. We do need to be careful about reading apocalyptic literature literally. Maybe the metaphor in John's vision is all about how in the new creation there will be nowhere to fear. There will be nothing which separates us from others. There will be no thing to separate us and keep us from God. His good creation, once again, bringing order and glory to the brooding darkness. So Paul is sent to sea on a ship. Let's dive into chapter 27 together. This is verse 1. When it was decided that we would sail for Italy, Paul and some other prisoners were handed over to a centurion named Julius, who belonged to the Imperial Regiment. We boarded a ship from Adramyttium, about to sail for ports along the coast of the province of Asia. We put out to sea. Aristarchus, a Macedonian from Thessalonica, was with us. The next day we landed at Sidon, and Julius, in kindness to Paul, allowed him to go to his friend so that they might provide for his needs. So they're heading north from presumably Caesarea up the coast of Palestine to the next port, Sidon. I'd encourage you, if you can, to have a look at this on a map. Most study Bibles will have a map of Paul's journeys in there, and it's good just to have a look. It'll make so much sense to you if you can follow it on a map. Paul is placed in the care of a centurion named Julius from the Imperial Regiment, which sounds very impressive. And some commentators have suggested that he was part of a special kind of crack group of soldiers. However, other notable historians say this simply means that he was in the army of Imperial Rome, that is, the army which dominated the vast Roman Empire from 27 BC to 476 AD, so about 500 years. Paul is a prisoner. He's also a Roman citizen who was yet to be found guilty of a crime. So he's treated with kindness and a degree of freedom. He was allowed to visit his friends, undoubtedly fellow believers, in the seaport of Sidon, though I'm sure he would have been accompanied by a Roman soldier. For to lose Paul, to have him, you know, run off while in transit, meant very serious consequences for Julius. He would most likely be executed for dereliction of duty, so I'm sure they kept a careful eye on him. Verse 4 says, "From there we put out to sea again and passed to the lee of Cyprus, because the winds were against us." The winds were blowing from the southwest, so they decided to take the longer route around the top of the island of Cyprus. This is what Luke means by saying the lee of Cyprus, the side that is protected from the wind. Now, if you look at wind maps of this region, you'll notice that the strong winds which blow up from the southern Mediterranean kind of swirl around Cyprus and eventually blow westward as they hit the coast of the mainland, which is exactly the direction they wanted to go. I think it's also worth noting that Luke, once again, uses the plural first-person tense here, that is, the kind of we, indicating that he was most likely on the ship with Paul making this journey, which is why his description is so full of this kind of wonderful detail. He says, "When we had sailed across the open sea off the coast of Cilicia and Pamphylia, we landed at Myra in Lycia. There the centurion found an Alexandrian ship sailing for Italy and put us on board." So they left the protection of the island, sailed across an open stretch of sea to the port of Myra, and here it was decided that they should change ships. Luke tells us that their centurion, Julius, found them a ship from Alexandria bound for Italy. Now, this means that it was a ship which was making the continual circuit from the vast wheat fields of Egypt to Rome. The ship was full of grain, remember that. Also remember that this ship was treated very differently when it landed, simply because it came with such endorsement from the emperor himself. You didn't want to be found to be in any way hindering the progress of one of these transports. These ships, and particularly their cargo of wheat, were extremely important to the citizens of Rome. This was the foundation of their food supply, and as a result, captains and ship owners were rewarded handsomely for maintaining the supply of grain, despite the dangers. So Julius, the centurion, found them one of these ships from Alexandria bound for Italy. Verse 7 says, we made slow progress for many days and had difficulty arriving off Cnidus. When the wind did not allow us to hold our course, we sailed to the lee of Crete opposite Salmone. We moved along the coast with difficulty and came to a place called Fair Havens near the town of Lasea. They were trying to continue their westward journey, but the winds from the north were too strong, so they were blown south toward the island of Crete. Once they made it round to the southern side of the island, they were protected from the strong northerly winds that were giving them so much grief, and they were able to carefully make their way along the coast to a place called Fair Havens. Now, verse 9 says, "Much time had been lost, and sailing had already become dangerous because by now it was after the fast. What is this all about, the fast? The fast which Luke speaks of is the Day of Atonement, or the Yom Kippur festival, which was on the 5th of October in AD 59. It has come and gone. Winter was just around the corner. Sailing started to get dangerous in the eastern Mediterranean in mid-September and normally stopped altogether by mid-November. Remember, this is the northern hemisphere for those of us in the southern hemisphere. So winter starts late December, and nobody in the first century went to sea in winter. That was a suicide mission. Ships of the day simply could not cope with the storms that raged across the relatively shallow waters of the Mediterranean Sea. Here they were in the middle of their journey in the second week of October. Normally, ships would by this time have found a safe harbour to stay put in until the calmer days and nights of spring. The trouble with fair havens, or as it's sometimes called, safe harbour, where they were, is that it wasn't really that safe. And on top of that, the nearby town of Lasea wasn't really that close. It was a few miles inland from the harbour. From the sailors' point of view, it wasn't the best spot to winter. For passengers, I guess it was okay. They could stay in the township. But for those who had to stay with the ship, it was a fairly long way to travel into town and back. So Paul warned them, "Men, I can see that our voyage is going to be disastrous and bring great loss to ship and cargo and to our own lives also." Paul, by this stage, is a seasoned traveller. He's been shipwrecked and adrift at sea more than once already, and clearly he doesn't want to go through that again. Verse 11 says, "But the centurion, instead of listening to what Paul said, followed the advice of the pilot and of the owner of the ship. Since the harbour was unsuitable to winter in, the majority decided that we should sail on, hoping to reach Phoenix and winter there. This was a harbour in Crete facing both southwest and northwest." So Paul's advice was ignored and they headed back out to sea as soon as a gentle breeze from the south started up. Verse 13 says, "When a gentle south wind began to blow, they thought they had obtained what they wanted. So they weighed anchor and sailed along the shore of Crete. Before very long, a wind of hurricane force called the Northeaster swept down from the island. The ship was caught by the storm and could not head into the wind, so we gave way to it and were driven along. They'd left the harbour and they couldn't turn back. They had no motor, they were completely at the mercy of the weather. A violent wind from the opposite direction came out of nowhere, and suddenly they were in all sorts of trouble. They were heading for the small island just to the south of Crete called Corda. I guess they feared that they might be smashed against her rocks, but they managed to somehow steer the ship around behind the island where there was some shelter. And here they grabbed the chance to pull the small lifeboat they were towing aboard. By this stage, it was probably half full of water, and they had a great deal of difficulty getting it under control. Then they passed ropes around the hull to try to hold it all together. Just imagine that. We find out later on that there were nearly 300 people aboard. Just try to imagine the terror of shipping in these times with hurricane winds blowing them out into the open Mediterranean. Waves were coming out of the really shallow Aegean Sea that would have been standing up and probably breaking over the deck. They weren't out in the middle of the deep Pacific Ocean. They were in shallow waters and they were very afraid of being driven into the huge sandbars that were not that far away, the Syrtis sandbars. They were enormous. It's worth having a look at these on a map if you can. They are at least half the size of Italy, lying in the southern Mediterranean Sea, and they are often covered in seaweed. When ships got caught on them, there was simply no escape. Their danger was legendary, and Greek mythology makes much of their terrors. Luke writes, "As we passed to the lee of a small island called Corda, we were hardly able to make the lifeboat secure. When the men had hoisted it aboard, they passed ropes under the ship itself to hold it together. Fearing that they would run aground on the sandbars of Syrtis, they lowered the sea anchor and let the ship be driven along." Do you know what a sea anchor is? It's kind of like a parachute that's thrown out the back attached to a long rope. It simply slows the ship down to stop it crashing down the face of the huge waves. He says, we took such a violent battering from the storm that the next day they began to throw the cargo overboard. On the third day, they threw the ship's tackle overboard with their own hands. When neither sun nor stars appeared for many days, and the storm continued raging, we finally gave up all hope of being saved. This was on the third day. The ship was full of grain. Grain is heavy, and they were sinking. They needed to make the ship more buoyant, so they started jettisoning the bags of grain, and then they even started to pull the ship apart, getting rid of any of the heavy rigging to keep her afloat. This was the third day. You know, I can't help seeing the parallels between the story of Jesus' trial, his crucifixion, his day of atoning for sins, his 3 days in the tomb, and then the angel's glorious words of hope. He is risen, and Paul's situation. Paul was on trial. He was sent to sea, the source of all their fears. They had found safe harbour in a place called Safe Harbour, Fair Havens. But against good advice, on the Day of Atonement, they set out anyway. 3 days of terrible storm, 3 days of being dragged by the wind where they did not want to go, 3 days like death. But then the angel of the Lord appeared to Paul and said, "Do not be afraid." Just like the angels said to Mary when she stood outside the empty tomb, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, he is risen." But, and I really want you to see this, just as when Jesus rose to new life from the dead, and there was now a completely new kind of hope, a new kind of future for all of those who would put their hope in Christ, there was now a new kind of hope for all those aboard who stayed with Paul. However, their ultimate salvation, the end of the storm, wasn't visible just yet. They still had a whole lot more struggle, a whole lot more seasickness, a whole lot more hunger and exhaustion to go. You see, they were just like us, or we are just like them. Either way is the same. The Lord Jesus has risen from the dead. Sin and death has been defeated. Our eternal salvation, our hope is secure. But we are still in the midst of the storm, and we have a whole lot more storm to go before we reach our ultimate safe harbour. Let's read on. I think you'll start to see what I mean. Verse 21 says, "After the men had gone a long time without food, Paul stood up before them and said, 'Men, you should have taken my advice not to sail from Crete. Then you would have spared yourself this damage and loss. But now I urge you to keep up your courage, because not one of you will be lost. Only the ship will be destroyed. Last night an angel of the God whose I am and whom I serve stood before me and said, 'Do not be afraid, Paul. You must stand trial before Caesar. And God has graciously given you the lives of all who sail with you. So keep up your courage, men, for I have faith in God that it will happen just as he told me. Nevertheless, we must run aground on some island.'" You know, at times, Paul was such an abrasive kind of guy, wasn't he? And I actually love this about Acts and the Bible generally. The characters are so human, so real. I reckon I'd be exactly the same in this situation. Paul couldn't help telling them, "I told you so." He really was an outspoken bossy boots when you consider that he's actually a prisoner being transported to Rome for trial. It's not as though he's the owner of the ship or anything, and I'm sure they would have given very little weight to his story of an angelic vision during the terrors of the previous night as they were continuing to bob around like corks on the sea. And besides, didn't Paul also tell them that the ship would ultimately be lost as they were run aground on some island? Verse 27 says, "On the 14th night, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea." Just pause there and think about that for a moment. 14 days and nights at sea in a terrible storm in an ancient timber boat with no knowledge of where they were or where they were heading. They couldn't see the stars, and the magnetic compass wouldn't be invented by the Chinese for another 1,000 or 1,200 years. 276 people on board, terrified, hungry, exhausted, and without hope. Except for Paul's words about an angelic vision. On the 14th night, he says, we were still being driven across the Adriatic Sea. When about midnight, the sailors sensed they were approaching land. They took soundings and found that the water was 120 feet deep. A short time later, they took soundings again and found it was 90 feet deep. Fearing that they would be dashed against the rocks, they dropped four anchors from the stern and prayed for daylight. Now, we know from seafloor archaeology how this system worked. Divers working their way along the seabed have located anchors dropped in sequence to slow the ship down. One after another, the anchor ropes would break, but then there would be the next one and the next one and the next one. There's a bay on the southeastern side of Malta called St. Thomas Bay. And this is the bay on Malta which most accurately matches Luke's description. There is a St. Paul's Bay not far away on the northwestern side, but it was most likely this bay where the shipwreck occurred. When you see it sitting on the huge Mediterranean Sea, the island of Malta appears very small. It's simply amazing, a miracle that they came upon not only the island, but this very bay. Clearly, one can imagine as they approached this bay in the dark, with any real understanding of just what was ahead, the sailors would have heard waves crashing on the nearby rocks and reefs. They'd taken soundings, and they knew it was getting shallower. I can understand them praying for daylight. But then Paul noticed that the sailors, scurvy dogs, were trying to slip away from the ship in the lifeboat and make for the land, which they knew had to be nearby. And Luke says, in an attempt to escape from the ship, the sailors let the lifeboat down into the sea, pretending they were going to lower some anchors from the bow. Then Paul said to the centurion and the soldiers, unless these men stay with the ship, you cannot be saved. So the soldiers cut the ropes that held the lifeboat and let it fall away. Basically, the Roman soldiers said, there's only one boat, and you guys aren't leaving us on your ship to fend for ourselves. So they cut the boat free. I think Paul must have sensed that things were really starting to fall apart. They were all at the end of their tether. In the midst of their great anguish and distress, Paul steps in and provides them comfort and encouragement. Verse 33 says, just before dawn, Paul urged them all to eat. For the last 14 days, he said, you have been in constant suspense and have gone without food. You haven't eaten anything. Now I urge you to take some food. You need it to survive. Not one of you will lose a single hair from his head. Now after he said this, he took some bread and gave thanks to God in front of them all. Then he broke it and began to eat. And they were all encouraged and ate some food themselves. Altogether, there were 276 of us on board. When they'd eaten as much as they wanted, they lightened the ship by throwing the grain into the sea. When daylight came, they did not recognize the land, but they saw a bay with a sandy beach where they decided to run the ship aground if they could. I've had a good look at the island of Malta from the satellite images, and I've read a bit about its coastline. I've even flown around it on Microsoft Flight Simulator to do a bit of an exploration. There are a lot of places on the coast of Malta that you would not want to be washed up on. Rocky, reefy, desolate places. But the Lord appears to have brought their ship straight into one of the few bays that had a sandy beach, and it would appear a freshwater stream flowing into the sea. Verse 40 says, cutting loose the anchors, they left them in the sea, and at the same time untied the ropes that held the rudders. Then they hoisted the foresail to the wind and made for the beach. But the ship struck a sandbar and ran aground. The bow stuck fast and would not move, and the stern was broken to pieces by the pounding of the surf. You know, this may at first appear to be disastrous, but having the ship break apart as the bow became more and more stuck in the sandbar actually provided pieces of timber, flotsam and jetsam, for the 276 passengers to make it safely to shore. Many of them would not have been able to swim, so this was actually a blessing. This was God's provision in the midst of the storm. And then after everything they had been through, when safety seemed so close, suddenly there was one last peril. The soldiers planned to kill the prisoners to prevent any of them from swimming away and escaping. That's what verse 42 tells us. Paul and his companion must have thought to themselves, you have got to be kidding. After everything we have been through over the past 2 weeks of this dreadful storm, and now that we're about to jump overboard and swim to shore, you want to kill all the prisoners to make sure we don't swim away Where are we going to swim to? But the centurion wanted to spare Paul's life and kept them from carrying out their plan. He ordered those who could swim to jump overboard first and get to land. The rest were to get there on planks or on pieces of the ship. And this way everyone reached land in safety. It really is quite a story of God's protection and provision, is it not? Let me finish by just saying this. Lots of Christians are under the impression that once they've placed their trust in Jesus, everything ought to flow smoothly. That their journey through this life should be like a gentle cruise across the Greek Isles and the glistening waters of the Aegean. The book of Acts, on the other hand, paints a very different and somewhat unsettling picture and says to us, you have not yet considered what it really means to take up your cross and follow Jesus. Tom Wright says, if the gospel of Jesus, the crucified and risen Messiah, means anything at all, it means that those who carry it will have it branded into their own souls. In a lot of ways, the local church, I think, is like a small ship trying to make a journey across the ocean of this life. The whole of humanity is not on the ship, and we don't even get to travel with all the believers, for they are scattered far and wide, both across the globe and across the centuries. We really only get to travel through this life with a relatively small group of people in this time and this place. That's why this little group of fellow travellers, our shipmates, are so important. And if we think that our journey through this life will be without storms, we are dreaming. We are having ourselves on. But in saying that, the storms don't in any way mean that our journey is futile. The storms simply mean that Jesus is claiming us, and in fact the whole world, as his own, and the powers, the rulers of this world will do their utmost to resist us at every turn. In the midst of the storms, we know what's really going on, and we simply recognize this as the mark of the cross on our very soul. There are going to be times when our enemy is going to throw everything he has at us, but the Lord will see us safely home. If there's one thing I think we've learnt from making our way through Acts, is that there are going to be difficult and challenging days in this life, but the Lord always brought his people through them. And he often gave them periods of enforced rest following these times of trial. The pressure wasn't relentless, and we see this in the next chapter. The people of Malta were very hospitable and welcoming, and Paul and his companions were able to rest and recuperate across the winter months before sailing off again for Rome in the spring. I'll say it again because this is so important. In the midst of the storms, we know what's really going on, and we simply recognize this as the mark of the cross on our very soul. There are going to be times when our enemy is going to throw everything he has at us, but the Lord will see us safely home. Amen.